Stop, Tiger.
Mm-mm-mm.
And I congratulate you. I saw your pictures. Charlotte was so pretty. And I'm gonna get the stuff. They just came and I just paid rent. So
I will send you the wonderful. Sometimes Zoom is very, very aggravating.
Yes.
It's a mean thing. So, Mr. Tom, nice to meet you in person.
Yeah.
There are several possibilities for our conversation today, and I would like to go with your list of information and your PowerPoint slide that you sent. And then if you wish to, we can carry on with any further interview questions you'd like to answer according to what we have been discussing with students. So with that in mind, which would you like to cover first, the history of this project, your slide, or something else?
Well, I maybe a little bit on the history of the project, and it was a outflow of our 50th reunion in 2016 that we had as a panel during our time together, a discussion of the civil rights activism that had gone on while we were at Swarthmore. And Judy Richardson, who in our class who dropped out to be part of SNCC, was back and present. Penny Patch was there, and Walt, I'm forgetting his, Walt Popper. I had join in to give his perspective, but we had a lot of people present and good discussion. And it just occurred to me that this time would be great if we could create oral histories of people who were actually present in reading about our times. I did come across this article by Wesley Hogan from 2002 on how democracy travels. And then it goes on to include Swarthmore in the title and whatnot. And in that article, she has footnotes referring to my classmates. And she also did reach out and do some interviewing of various Swarthmore alums. And, but it occurred to me, you know, it's great when she's bringing it forward, but what would it be like if those individuals actually were talking about their experiences and making it personal? That was one motivating force. A different one was that I did find these letters that Meg Hotchkin Lippert of the class of 1964 had sent to me while she was near Somerville, Tennessee during the summer of 1963. And I had transcribed typed those letters up into a Word document, especially as they pertain to her work in Tennessee. And then actually I myself did some interviewing, and I know that you have the document that we jointly prepared, but is in her voice, of her experience in Tennessee, both from a work camp that took place in this for spring break 1963, and then for the summer. And that work was promoted by the American Friends Service Committee. It was American Friends Service Committee work camp that was building a cinder block community center in Somerville, where there had been a tent city created because when voter registration began, landlords then evicted Black families, people from their from the homes that these landlords owned. And so they actually set up a tent city, and then they were building a community center. And that work camp in the spring also featured a number of my classmates, Tony Loeb, Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, then Linda Lines got involved, and she has actually provided some newspaper articles that were written in the summer of 63 when she spent time in the county north of Somerville. I think it was Brownsville or whatever the town is up there. And so she was involved, as Meg was, in some follow-up time, and in voter register for the summer work was voter registration. And so it seemed like an opportunity. It also clearly, once we hit our 50th reunion, we're all people in our 70s, and two things are going on. We're sometimes not remembering things so clearly. And secondly, of course, some of us, unfortunately, some key people like Vernon Grizzard and others had already died. So that it seemed timely that we get this going if we were to get people who had memories still of what the action was like. And so I contacted Daniel Pope, Frank Cochran, two members of our class that were quite active in the civil rights work. I also talked to Carl Abbott, who, like Daniel, has been a historian. And so it seemed to me important that we have historians in our class overseeing the project. My main interest was that we could provide raw material for any future historical studies, and that these interviews would be of interest. But the other thing is, Frank immediately came up with the letters that he had written home when he was living in Cambridge, Maryland during the summer of 1963. And so part of getting in touch with classmates was not only to get their memories from now, but any material such as letters that were written at the time that would give you such a picture in which memory didn't play such a role, rather that you could get a sense of the activity. And so we got talking about this, and Frank visited campus in a timely manner. I don't know exactly when I think it was still in 2016. And he met with, her last name is Dorsey, a professor, Swarthmore professor, a Black Swarthmore professor who And she almost, and he also met with, didn't quite do all my homework on names, but he was the man in charge of the digital work.
Roberto Vargas.
Roberto is the humanities, but this was at a separate, he's left.
Yes, Roberto is the only one left who worked on the original project.
That's right. Yes, we had Stephanie Ramsey,
who worked. She did a lot of the interviews.
She did the interviews. She came with, she had done a senior thesis wherever she went to college on civil rights. So she was really primed to do this, and then got trained in doing oral history work. So she was working with the library, and I can't come up with his name. But at any rate, Frank met with him, and that gave us an in through him to the librarians. And that's how we got to Roberto and also to Stephanie. And so we, sorry about the phone call. It's one of these spam calls that come through all of them.
The same system. I'm very familiar with that.
Yeah, it'll end here in a minute. So we got talking with the historians, and I mean with the librarians, and I think this was a time when our little committee was able to meet with the librarians. We did it by conference call, and I may have been Roberto mentioned that, I think it's Peggy Fleming who's in charge of libraries, or was. Any rate, she mentioned that there was an alum who had given money to Swarthmore to promote oral history work and even training of Swarthmore students in doing the library history, oral history work. And when we asked who that alum was, it turned out to be Ross Ogden, who's in our class. And he had given the money because his wife, or his former wife, she had died, unfortunately. But she had made a career of doing oral histories in their local community. And so in memory of her, he was making these funds available to introduce Swarthmore students to oral history work. And so we had a marvelous convergence of interests. Our interest was picked up by the librarians, was at a time when there was funding from Ross coming in, and there was Stephanie ready to do some of the interviewing. So we did get going. And then as has happened here, got undercut by the fact that Stephanie got a better job at Temple and left, and then it was a long time to get her replacement in. But finally, when we've gotten David Overmeyer here, we've really gotten going again, and that's led directly to your being hired to continue the interviewing, which we're all very excited about having happen. I guess I would say a different source of, or what I thought this accumulation of interviews and papers and all would be there to interest various Swarthmore students who might have interest in the institution and what was going on. because certainly by the time we got started, there was this excellent web page about the Black Revolution and all that had gone on in 1969 when the Black students got it together and occupied Parrish, and it really pushed to open things up. I'm in touch with a Jim Colvin, who's in the class of 1971, and he affirms that, you see, by 69, there were enough Black students on campus, there was a critical mass that they could really lead something. Our class had an advance over the previous classes in that we had 7 Black students admitted, 4 men and 3 women. So Swarthmore was not at all diverse in our day, but had begun to expand slowly. And by 1969, I infer that there was progress on that front of having more Black students in the student body, and things had really changed. But in our day, civil rights was very was quite active, and it was a time when white students or white participants were welcomed into certain communities, such as there in Somerville in southwestern Tennessee for voter registration, and as they were both in Cambridge, Maryland, and in Chester, to support ongoing movements led by various Black leaders like Gloria Richardson or Stanley Branch, so that there was an opening for the various students at Swarthmore to be active. And we also had a lot of leadership on campus, Mimi Feingold, Carl Whitman among them, where they were out ahead in making making it us aware of what was going on. Mimi Feingold had a series of articles in the Phoenix telling of the activities of Swarthmore students in the previous summer and various civil rights activities around the country. And so when we entered at Swarthmore, there was, this was what was going on. There definitely were many people with deep concerns for social justice and civil rights, and there were leaders at Swarthmore making things happen. And so I arrived. I did say to my wife today, I said, I was going to be interviewed by you. And she looked at me and says, but you weren't active. And I said, well, I can talk about the project we have going now. That's my activity. But I, like a number of students, came having been a bit active. I had joined the NAACP in Madison, Wisconsin, and came out of a youth group at our church. There was a lot of interest in this sort of activity. But I have to confess that once I got to Swarthmore, I was definitely overwhelmed by the amount of work. In our freshman year at Swarthmore, all the courses were graded, and we were required to take 5 courses. So there was a heavy load. It wasn't until a few years after us that Swarthmore went over to, as I remember it, dropped it down to 4 courses per semester for students, with those initial courses not being graded. They were pass-fail, which took a lot of pressure off students in their freshman year. But that wasn't the case in our year. And so I was a cheerleader for my classmates who got involved, and certainly listened with a lot of interest when they came back telling of what had gone on, first in going down to Cambridge, Maryland in that spring of 63, spring semester of our freshman year, and then in the fall of 63 when things got going in Chester. And for a long time, I've told about how essentially 10% of the student body was at one point arrested in Chester. Well, I think there were something over 900 students at Swarthmore, put it. And so when 90 students were arrested, that gave me my 10% figure and I was rather proud of our student body for being so active. My own activity in that time was to join up on the tutoring project that had been going on and continued to go on in Chester. And we would go in on an evening to some building, maybe a church basement or whatever, and meet with individual students and do some tutoring. My only story on that was, having grown up in Madison, Wisconsin, where as a, I don't know whether second grade, third grade, if I needed to go somewhere, I mean, I knew I could go down, catch the bus, pay 5 cents to ride the bus downtown. And I was used to riding public buses, whether it was during the day or night, it seemed perfectly safe. And but one of the times I went in to tutor in Chester, I'm not clear exactly how I got in there, but when it was over, I came out, I came out on the street there and walked to where the bus stop was to wait for the bus, which eventually came and took me. But before it came, I could remember this large black guy coming up, and he more or less just was startled to see this sort of innocent white guy standing out on the street at that point. And didn't do anything. But I was completely naive about potential dangers of getting mugged. And shortly thereafter, I remember a notice went to all of us who were tutoring that there were cars going and we should go to Chester by car and back. They suddenly realized they had naive people like me who could put ourselves in harm's way without knowing that there might be potential dangers. But that's the
Do you see anyone follow you while you were, after you switched from bus to car?
No, well, I mean, in the sense, I mean, when we were, you know, it's worth more, there were just very few cars. Students had to register for them, and they largely had to register for cars if they were going to be used for some activity. And so what would happen would be, you know, I would go somewhere on campus and get picked up and driven. And then when things were over, I'd ride back. But I don't remember anything beyond that. So. So I'm I don't know. There's it's been really good to be working with Frank and Carl and Daniel in moving this project forward. And it's been great to be working with Roberto and now David in getting, keeping the project going. And so it's, and we're really delighted that you're giving it, you know, getting the interviewing going again. How many interviews have you done so far?
Thus far, 7. I have, let's see, 4 more scheduled. And I'm going back through the list because of these interviews. There have been mention of several names of people that I might be interested in speaking with. In fact, I'm preparing the report that you all would like to receive on how things are going. So this will be a repeat then when you get the report. I have had 2 people say no, and Meg is up in the air. She wants to review her transcript, and I'm trying to prepare that now as well. One person didn't want to because it was too upsetting to think about all that happened. And Brian Stevenson is too busy, even though I begged him for way into July if he could do it, but he's too busy, I understand. And I am going to be able to schedule after July with Ollie Fine and his wife. I have had, I think, 2 wives in the background with some of the folks that I have spoken with, and 1 husband that popped in to the video, so that's good.
Yeah.
I have also discovered some locations that I have not heard mentioned by anyone to this point. One being Carrboro, North Carolina, and I think that was David Gelber.
Mm-hmm.
And a place in Georgia that Patch mentioned. And
Dillinger.
Yes. And so we're going to talk a little more about that spot. I am currently in Atlanta, Georgia, so it was interesting to even conceive that what he described could exist in Georgia, especially back then.
Yeah.
I was amazed. We have an actual Friends Assembly, a large church here in Midtown, and then at least 2 Unitarian Universalist churches, which I love that denomination, love it. And so we're moving forward. I would say that, in fact, now might be a good time to switch to your slide so we could look at these locations. And looking at your slide, I noticed a lot of what I was hearing was being borne out in the slide you provided, that being that essentially the war took over the civil rights activities, which only made sense after the acts were passed, and you know, at least there's some opening. It made sense that Vietnam took over everything. I also watched that war on TV from age 3 to the end. I didn't really start watching it until 66, I think. I am not even 18 months now from 60. I'm not real happy about that, but you know, it is what it is. So let's take a look at this slide. I found this very interesting. Okay, come on, Zoom. Oh yeah, here we go. I needed my mouse to come back on. So I will share this and we can talk further.
Sure.
Come on now. There we go.
Oh, you got it. Perfect.
So let's talk about this. I'm going to make it large. All right. Can you see that?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So first thing I really wanted to know about this is the very first box that indicates several, well, a conglomeration of points of interest that led to a great deal of activity on the part of students. So in South Africa, yes, of course, we know apartheid, a mess. But what in Africa in this box are you indicating you all worked with?
That those were articles that pertained perhaps on one hand to, of course, the liberation of African nations that was going on in parallel with the civil rights movement here. Mm-hmm. And there was cross-fertilization between African students who came to universities here in this country, and their movement and the civil rights movement, I mean, found common cause. And there were just a very few Black students at Swarthmore who were from Africa. They definitely made the soccer team a better team but they also would at times write letters and commentary on what was going on. So I'd have to really relook at how I came, but it was astounding to me to step back from, I mean, our time started in 62, 63, we came in the fall of 62, to step back 2 years and to see that, originally there weren't all this activity and there wasn't anybody like Mimi Feingold telling of student activities, but there were articles either about African, what was going on in Africa or by these African students. And so that's how I came to put that label on those articles. They're definitely touching on civil rights, but not the specific activities. In the fall of 61, SNCC gets going and gets mentioned. Chester there probably was the tutoring project.
Yes, I would imagine.
And it isn't until the real activity in Chester started then in the fall of 63 and carries on to spring of 64 and fall of 64, but then of course, Cambridge was a big focus in the spring of 63. And there's some indication that people were interested even in the spring of 62. So, I found that quite telling to see this switch over from a majority civil rights activity in 63, 64. And it was not, as you were noting, the passage of the Civil Rights Acts there in 64 did sort of bring, I don't, well, you can't say closure by any means, but they did bring the movement to a head at that point. But at the same time, Johnson got elected by a landslide and then really activated things in Vietnam. And so there's an element here of, you can see that we, and it was largely a white male, I mean, there was clearly 50-50 men, women, it's worth more. But among the males, we were all fearful of being drafted. And so there was definitely a shift to some extent, the protesting was self-protective or self-involved, where we were helping out with civil rights. Now, suddenly, we were at the center, and definitely lots of leadership came out of members of our class. Students for a Democratic Society had gotten going, and both Paul Booth in the class of 65 and then Nick Eagleson in our class stepped up in being president or head of SDS for a year. And so SPAC, which was quite active our freshman year and throughout, was also affiliated with SDS and ultimately provided leadership to that national group. And so, but it, you had, I really appreciated the way you've set up the interviews now, where you've put forward your questions ahead of time. And one of your questions is, how did the civil rights work phase with other civil rights work with women and gays and Latinos? I would just say none of those movements were really in evidence. Certainly, there was no open discussion about anybody being gay. Certainly, there were a number of gay students, a number of them I knew, basically, but it was more intuitively than explicitly while I was there. And but there was no discussion, or nobody was out, and that sort of thing was not going on. I did pick up on a couple of articles on, I did late, on this, I said feminism or women's issues, but again, it's it's barely discernible on the graph on the histogram. So it was quite a remarkable time in what we were talking about and what we weren't. And I think Latinos weren't an issue because, again, there weren't, there was no, I don't think there was any conscious effort of accepting people of that background. It's worth more. There were a few Asian students that, but it was not a diverse place at our, during our years. And so.
I have a question.
Sure.
So as more Black students are being admitted to Swarthmore, in fact, a few people that I interviewed had Black roommates. And as more students were being admitted, as we move further past the 65 point and the war really, really ramps up, now it becomes a convergence of Black and white men with the same issues. So did you have any sense or any experiences with the Black male students who were also going to be drafted like you all might be if they, you know, left school or what have you? What were your memories of that?
I'm afraid I don't have specific memories. Certainly, I think it was a concern for people like John Morrow or Jim Smith, and even Al Chappelle, who, but by then, I mean, the other black male who was in our class was came in as Delmar Scudder, and but he changed his name to Rasaba Sudakasa Kayasa, and but I believe I've been informed, unfortunately, that he has died. But he was somebody who, like Judy Richardson, dropped out, I think, to be active, more active in civil rights. And I did, as class president, I did hear from him once. He called me up and we had a short conversation, but I don't know what his much about his own experience. But you're right. Yeah, we were all, as males, threatened together, the same dilemma. And but certainly a number of our classmates took up the issue of draft resistance. And I, in setting up this particular project, I decided we'd focus on civil rights, just so we didn't get too broadly, but it's no question that those active in civil rights were some of the ones who moved on to be most active around the anti-draft, anti-war movement. And so, yes.
Let me ask you about your arrest experiences. It's interesting that when the folks got arrested in North Carolina, they were actually defended and released in part through the work of Floyd McKissick, who I am familiar with from other locations. So tell me about your arrest experiences, who you met, who you talked to, who got you out.
Well, again, I'm...
You weren't there, but let's say hearsay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I heard about various stories from my classmates and those who got locked up in Chester. We talked about it. Unfortunately, I can't give you any direct memories right now of what they told me at the time, but there are some write-ups on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have you got Linda Lines Krotzenmuir on your list as somebody to interview?
Mm-hmm. Let's see.
Linda.
Let's see if I can make this smaller so I can see. No, I won't be able to, but I will definitely review to make sure. Let's see. Let me look in here. I have the phone. I can look in the drive this way. But I am attempting to follow up with anyone mentioned to me during oral history interviews so that I can attempt to find these folks and interview them as well if they are available.
Right. Well, I can.
And yes, please do.
I can send you her email address as of 2016. And, but she provided us with two newspaper articles that essentially are her write-up of being in South Western Tennessee in the summer of 1963. So her work would complement that of Meg Lippert. And so she would be, has John Morrow gotten on your list as he's a black classmate in our, and he's a historian. And has been chair of the history department at the University of Georgia. So
this is whom again? John Morrow?
M-O-R-R-O-W.
Oh, well, I will absolutely try to get in touch with him. I might know him from something else. So,
his wife was in the class of, was in the class of 1969. And so she and I think he both get depicted in on the website of the Black Revolution. Let me see if I can get her name. I know there's in our yearbook. Yeah, there she is. Diana Batts, Morrow, but Diana Batts was in the class of 69. And but John may not be able to give you direct stories about civil rights, but he'll have his memory of what of what was going on campus. I mean, yeah, obviously he was a participant without having to be out protesting. He was integrating Swarthmore.
Mm-hmm.
He's carried on in leadership at Georgia. And so the whole has affected his career. I mean, he's had a fantastic career as a military historian, interestingly enough. And we had a
great- just published a book recently.
He's probably has. He's got several books out. Quite interesting.
Yeah. Let's see here.
He had one on World War I that I read and really was fascinated by. And I know he's been at work on one for World War II in a somewhat similar vein, but he has a number of other books out, but quite prolific. Mm-hmm. But I think he would be a great one to give perspective on, on campus life.
Let's see if I can get to him in a snap. Let's see. John H. Morrow Jr.
I think that would be he.
Yep, I can get to him in a snap. We'll call him right now. Yep, that's him. His email address is at UGA.
Mm-hmm. Good. Great. Did you know him by some other?
I do.
Action? Yep.
I know several people affiliated with you all through another organization that's fairly secret. So I'm going to keep it that way. But because I deal with that organization, I have their directory. So I can just click, call them up.
Good. Well, that's
I'm under- very happy to know. In fact, let me make sure. Let me just write that on the side so I make sure to look at that right this minute. I was really, really so hoping to speak to any remaining Black students. There are so few, and I was just so heartbroken to know that Glory Richardson passed away just recently.
Yes.
She is my sorority sister, or would have been. She is now an Ivy Beyond the Wall. But certainly, I want to talk to anyone and everyone because I am trying to capture a picture of the world in which you all lived and what possessed you, quote unquote, to do what you did, especially since it was so dangerous.
Yes.
And because you all have such wide backgrounds. Some are Quakers, some are not, some are atheists. Some are socialists, some are communists. I want to hear the whole story. And as far as oral history is concerned, this is memory. This is not intended to in any way be factual. This is truly your memories that I'm trying to go for. So anyone I could talk to is wonderful. And as you all name people, I tend to go and research these folks to find out what happened to them. One gentleman has now passed away, but he kept up a civil rights and human rights page on the internet for quite some time, because of course the issues haven't gone away, and Lord have mercy, today they're not gone at all. They're even worse. I'm horrified today. I was just horrified. I'm going to stop sharing now to there you go, to just ask a few more questions. I'm very interested. I'm especially interested from people to know what they must have thought. Oh, goodness. What they're thinking right now, given the situations that we're in. And, you know, I tend to wake up in the middle of the night anyway. I would prefer not to, but I tend to wake up in the middle of the night. And last night, I woke up extremely early. Like, first I woke up at almost 11, and then I woke up at 2 something and saw the news, and I couldn't go back to sleep. I not until about 6 o'clock, because my eyes were closing from reading and wondering, oh Lord, are they serious? So what do you think about all this mess?
Well, I'm horrified by the rise of the far right and all of this, you know, attitudes that you can lie and avoid science and such. It's it seems like a foreign world, and where all this backing came from is quite a mystery, by my background. But it's been awful to watch.
I wonder, given that at least the current research is suggesting strongly that this all got started in 1970-ish around the Nixon administration and the quiet beginnings of certain attacks against certain people, like the war on drugs, for instance. And so I wonder if you have any commentary about the sort of quiet and insipidous rise that just crept along and suddenly, bam, here it is.
Yeah. Well, it's clear certain people got very busy, and it would seem there was a strategy to invest in races, in political races at the state level, and thus take over state legislatures as well as getting governors in, and then enacting various policies at that level and sort of undercut the federal government and actions. And of course, it's a big mystery to me that after the 2020 election, when everybody knew there was just a short 2-year window of Democratic control of Congress, that they didn't get things together to protect the voting acts. It's sort of like almost political suicide now that they didn't pass something that would overrule what's coming down from so many of the states. And of course, those were, you know, those states that had Republican secretaries of state up until 2020, you know, these people had some real integrity to them, and now those sort of people are being voted out of office. And so how things are going to go in the future for voting is very scary to think about, how many individuals are going to be disenfranchised. Quite a step backward.
It's sort of like, being right here in Atlanta right today,
mm-hmm.
and having the crazy governor, I'm sorry we share a last name, it's an accident, but having the crazy governor actually try to pass this, he signed it the other day, a similar bill to Florida of don't say gay and don't talk about critical race theory. I'm like, do you know where you live? Do you actually think that in the end, one of the most vocal protesting places I've ever seen is going to be quiet? Do you actually think that we're not going to teach our children about the Atlanta child murders, about Julian Bond and John Lewis and how John Lewis bested him? Do you actually think that's going to occur? What did you think you were going to do? The gun rights thing just drives me insane. It's like, okay, you think that now that you've signed the law that no one has to have a license, what do you think that's going to do? You don't actually think that South of 20 is going to run cowering, do you? Maybe you have to be shown. And, you know, here we are today standing to make even more news because poor Fannie Willis is collecting her grand jury and seating it right now. And, you know, like a huge block radius is shut off because, you know, they have to guard the place now. It's crazy.
Yes, it is. And very sad, very sad.
Well, I wonder if given the way your group of students, the 60 students, were able to push back against the federal government to sort of make them now hide and squirm through the states, of whether that very same thing can occur through student action, through group grassroots action, et cetera. It's bad enough that they leaked for the first time in history. It's bad enough they leaked the intended ruling of the Supreme Court against Roe v. Wade, which was actually kind of good. But since they leaked it, the fight has already started. And if they have the nerve to pass it, then I think that, whereas we didn't get the Voting Rights Act, I'm pretty sure that will galvanize enough people to put them out of office, regardless of what district you've been gerrymandered into.
Yes. Well,
terrible.
Yes. Yes.
We can only pray.
Yes. It's sort of ironic that you have to hope the other side goes too far. I mean, you have to
keep going. Keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. People are calling for Elon Musk to let Trump back on Twitter. Yep. Let him back on there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let him talk. Mm-hmm. And that will remind people, in case you forgot, what you just lived through over the last 7 or so years. In case, I just don't understand why people can't hear this.
Absolutely.
I mean, I guess you all faced the same thing as you were going through trying to get people to vote or trying to get people to be able to improve their educational standing. You know, you saw a lot of the same thing.
Yep. Yep.
I would like to not say that. I don't know whether we're a society that can get past violence or not. I really don't know that. Despite the numbers of people, such as your Swarthmore students, who push for peace all the time, I just don't know that that actually works with this group of people we're working with.
Yes, yes. No, it's gotten very dangerous. And so far, you know, there were that group that was going to attack the governor of Michigan and you know, all of those, he's just crazies. And so it's a scary time, no question. And
I guess we're basically concluded, though I did want to ask you, did you find that the Quaker faith influenced you, or you did? Okay. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, they claimed at the time we came that the college was Quaker in tradition, and I think it was an admissions policy too, that students who had a Quaker background had a somewhat favored status in being accepted. So that, and as I came to get introduced to Quakerism, which I did at Swarthmore, I hadn't really paid attention before, the Quakers had a strong sense of social justice and work on civil rights. And there was AFSC as quite a social action group within the Quaker tradition. And my own friendship with Meg Hotchkin-Lippert, she has deep Quaker roots.
Yes, she does.
Definitely influenced me. And when I left Swarthmore, was in grad school, that's when I applied to be a conscientious objector.
Mm-hmm.
In my own small little protesting way. And it never went through because by the time and they were getting ready to act on it, I was moving out of draft age, but at the same time, it was the influence of Quakers. And actually, when I met my wife, because she was staying in a friend's cooperative housing building at the University of Wisconsin, where we were both in grad school. She's Jewish, but she, like me, was drawn to the pacifist stance and the anti-war stance that Quakers had. So it was a big influence. And I was fully aware through Meg of, with AFSC, of the activities and promotion of civil rights work. So I feel that's one of the two. I mean, there really was the leadership coming and out of that tradition from Quaker tradition for civil rights, and the other big leadership was coming from various Marxist backgrounds or was becoming the new left at SDS. And that was largely the students who were involved with SPAC. That they were bringing that forward. So there were those two elements that came together in the student body, promoting activism and giving some depth to it. One of the things that both my wife and I noted was that she went to Oberlin, I to Swarthmore, was that when you talked with the leaders and the activists, which you could do in a small college setting, there was a very real discussion. We might disagree or not, you know, follow all of, but we could have a full discussion with them. But when we got to the University of Wisconsin and there were big anti-war protests going on mainly, to get into discussions with people there, I found that they were more ideological.
Mm-hmm.
It was not as easy to have a conversation with them, but rather they seemed a little more locked into certain ideological points of view. So here they were, the it was a, quite a difference in leadership from what I had been used to at Swarthmore, where we were much more open with each other and friendly. And even if we disagreed, we talked together through all of these matters. So, yep.
Some of those split offs were, of course, as you know, very influential and some quite volatile. This question I have, I guess, in reading background material, did you see a sense of the idea that student activists, and perhaps what you're saying about their ideological and philosophical perspectives, did you see them really believing that their knowledge of students could save the world as opposed to something else? Did you feel they really felt their influence more strongly than perhaps it was actually felt by others?
Well, certainly there was an idealism among all of us mm-hmm. that we could make a difference. And there was quite an undercurrent of a change going on. And we were all, to some extent, thrown into odds with our parents, where my father had served in the Navy during World War II.
Mine too.
And so when, you know, I was ready to become a CO and not serve, there was definitely tension. And there were a number of my friends and peers who were even in very much stronger rebellion against their parents and their parents' views at that time. So it was quite a volatile period that Vietnam really split us. But I think civil rights didn't split us. You know, that was something, those values came down from my parents. So that side held. But when it came to the Vietnam War, that's brought out a lot of protest. And so.
I thank you for saying that. I have been, of course, have asked everyone, what did their parents think about their activity, especially if they got arrested? And everyone has mostly said that, well, you know, either their parents were the type who would have gotten arrested or did get arrested. An occasional one said that, well, you know, parents said, don't get arrested because you want to have a career later. No one has really said what you just said about, well, when it came to Vietnam, that was a different story. So, could you add any more information about, conversations you had with your parents about being a conscientious objector versus serving?
Well, I mean, one, they had the same sort of career worry, you know, why do you complicate your life? Why would you jeopardize that, you know, what you're doing by potentially having to go to jail if they didn't get granted. And but there was clearly, you know, a sense of following what the government wanted, even though, I mean, my parents were definitely liberals, but that was, and I found out, you know, I came to Swarthmore as a liberal, but I was much more in the middle at Swarthmore because there were so many people on the left with views that I'd never really paid any attention to or known about. So there's quite an education for me coming out of the Midwest in Madison, Wisconsin, to be at Swarthmore with people who'd grown up in the big cities in the East. And but it really bringing in, I think, more the Quakerism and the Quaker views. I definitely had some pretty strong arguments, especially with my father, in the years, not so much at Swarthmore, but once I was there, because my parents lived in Madison and that's where I went to grad school. So I would see them during that time I was applying as a CO and all. So, yep, that was a tough, but you've got my parents very much supporting civil rights, and my grandparents were a mixed bag because both my maternal grandmother and my paternal grandfather were from Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
I've got numerous relatives and some ancestors who were Confederate soldiers. And so there was, I have this confusing thing, but you know, fifth grade, we boys all wore Civil War hats. And I was one of two or three who had a Confederate hat rather than a Union hat. I grew up admiring Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and Jeb Stuart. I mean, these were all somewhat heroes to me, having nothing to do with slavery or their support. You know, it's just there was a Southern background. I almost carried a contradiction there. I think it's something to come up against now. But when you have Southern relatives, you go back and I can read about a great great grandfather selling a mother and child and, you know, feel horrified, but it can't change it. And so
it's history.
It's history.
We did. You may be able to change the future if you know the history, but now we're having that attack.
I can't turn around and suddenly not love my maternal grandmother. Mm-hmm. But I've put together some of the stories she has, or some of the, actually she helped edit things for my great great grandmother. Had a piece called Reminiscences of an Octogenarian, and this was a series of pieces that appeared in the Maury County newspaper, which is in central Tennessee at any rate. And she lived from 1808 until 1894. Mm-hmm. And so in just the time before she died, one of her daughters interviewed her, and she tells of life. They had a plantation, they had slaves, and then it draws out comments from my great grandmother and my grandmother that I'm horrified by because of what they, you know, they talk about these gentle people, and then they also, it's the type of thing that, so I'm excited to have these women's voices from back in the past. There are too few women whose views are out there, and so it's exciting to have this series. And yet, at the same time, I have to put in a little note now saying, I'm horrified by some of the views that get expressed there. But it's interesting to me to see how, my parents grew up. My paternal grandfather had a very ecumenical view and wasn't quite as prejudiced as my maternal grandmother, but that didn't live on in my parents. So I got a very different background. So it's fascinating to see how these, as we move from generation to generation, viewpoints change. And
we can hope for a good change for the future generation, since we insisted upon taking a little circle from the 60s to now. Hopefully we'll get it right this time. I am a extreme lover of genealogy and have watched every single show of Dear Dr. Skip Gates and Finding Your Roots, and I don't remember what it was before they changed the name after the Ben Affleck dust up there. But his work is fascinating. His growth is fascinating. And the way people are better able to understand and experience, their family's travel through history. And they're all gonna have very similar experiences. I'm not thrilled with slave owners, but they certainly existed. So, what can you do? Hopefully you can simply move forward and do something good for the people in front of you. But beyond that, and tell people history, beyond that, there's not much else you can do.
No, you can't change it. And if those people hadn't lived, I wouldn't be here, And
very true.
But it's, yep. Well, this has been, I'm glad we got a chance to chat. I hope a few of my memories are helpful to the general cause, but
all of them are, because you named names, you named experiences, you add your voice to the conversation that I'm so very happy to have. So I'm very, very pleased that we had this chance to talk.
Good.
And what we do from here is being discussed, I think, at this point, whether the website is going to be redone. I'm sure it is in some sort of way to add video to it, because video is all the rage these days.
Yep.
And, the transcripts will go into production, but I don't believe that David has any student workers to do the transcription until next term. So I'm going to just find as many more of you as I can to speak to, before my time is done, which has got to be, my time has to be done in September, because I finish my last two classes before, for all intents and purposes, thesis for my degree in archives and records management. So I have cut a lot of people off from September to now, and they're all like, but can't you? No, I have to do these classes. And I am a current archivist, and that may take on an enormous shift now, because we're changing some personnel. So I'm hoping that means that I get more personnel, because I have a monster collection to manage. So I just hope to continue living, and that COVID doesn't kill me, and riots don't kill me, and the stray bullets don't kill me. We kill so many people in this city every day. It is just like, oh, I'm so ready to leave here. Where can I go where they're just not shooting people all day, every day? Where is that?
Yes.
But then on the other hand, there's support Stacey Abrams,
Oh, wonderful person.
I would love her to be governor. I think it will be I just don't even know how she can make it, because I know how this state operates.
Yes. So
hopefully she will.
Well, with your state certainly came through in 2020.
Well, it certainly did. And Reverend Warnock is absolutely a jewel.
Yes.
Reverend Warnock is literally, in my opinion, a rebirth. I can't remember since Martin Luther King, nobody has spoken like him. Nobody. It's like, oh, listen to him talk. Oh. So I hope his words, you know, fall on good ears, and that I keep ducking and keep going until I fall out. That's my intention, and I'm going to stick to it.
That's great. Well, it's so neat how this project is sort of, and you're being able to work on it, dovetails with what you're doing otherwise. And so it's been very helpful to us to have you involved in this way. Very much appreciate it. So
I am extremely thrilled to do it. It's the funny thing. While I'm an archivist, I have learned to love records management, but I came to this field at the end of my career because I started my career as a museum curator. So I started collecting, you know, my hometown history and doing oral histories then. And I never thought about doing oral histories again until graduate school. And then lo and behold, here comes this little, oh, we need an oral historian. I'm like, oh, great. Let me go do this because it's worth more. And I went to Hollins and let's learn more about our sister schools. So I'm thrilled. And I hope to find at least another 12, 15 of you all to speak about this project before I'm done. I'm going to try my best.
Well, it's making a big difference for our project that you're involved and chasing down these people we've been waiting to have interviewed. And as I say, I think I was impressed with what you sent me in terms of prep work. The list of questions ahead of time was helpful to me on just writing things down, even though many of the questions didn't pertain to me because I wasn't a major activist. But at the same time, they allowed me to sort of think ahead, and I got some of the names down on paper so I wouldn't forget them when we talked about them here. And so this is... It seems you're proceeding in a way that's helpful to people. So, and those are, and also it seems to me that, you know, the questions you're asking show that you've read about our work. So you're asking about people that have been talked about and such. So that's really, thank you.
Thank you. And I hope to continue. Every time you all tell me something or send me something, I'm looking to see how that fits into this world that we're trying to create a picture of. So I appreciate it.
Well, I'll send you the Linda Lyons-Grotzener email.
I have her. I've interviewed her already.
You did? Okay.
Yes, I did. You'll see the people that I've interviewed when I send out the... requested report.
Good.
I hope to do today.
Well, you're wonderful to do that. It'll be helpful to the others to see this so we can all cheer you on.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Well, have a good afternoon. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Take care now.
Right.
Goodbye. Bye.